Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. This is your host, Paul Workus, with Christy Kleinschmidt again, talking about depression. How are you, Christy?
I am good, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm just doing fine. You know, this is a great conversation. We really appreciate your time and your expertise. Want to mention the call-up line this week?
I would love to mention the call-up line. So call up, so it's actually the consultation access landline for Utah Psychiatry is what call up stands for. So it actually is an acronym, and it is a legislative funded psychiatric access line. We are the 30th state in the country to have something like this. And it is basically your direct telephone line to talk to a child psychiatrist. There's two ways to reach us. You can call 801-587-3636 or go to our website, which is uofuhealth.org/call-up. And you can submit an online request as well. There is a psychiatrist who is available 12 to 4:30 Monday through Friday. And if you find yourself outside of those hours, you can either call that number and the contact agents will put in a request, and as soon as someone else is in the office, we'll give you a call, or you can submit an online request and during the next business hours, we'll call you back.
It's just such a valuable lifeline. I mean, it's really the best kind of phone a friend when you're feeling over your head. We talked last week about the difficulty sometimes in, because there just aren't enough of you guys. It is so wonderful to be able to reach out and sort out, so what do I do next with this patient? You guys have been so helpful with that. So thanks for that.
Oh, of course. I also just want to say we love doing it, and no question is too small for us, seriously. So I just don't want people to hesitate calling because they feel like they're burdening us. I mean, we literally get paid to sit by a phone and answer calls from you guys. So please use us.
And by the way, everyone should feel free to send a love letter to your representative to the legislature and thank them for keeping this afloat and keeping it going. This is a lifeline. So thanks so much. Well, let's talk a little bit this week. Have you developed any conflicts that you want to talk about?
I still have no conflicts of interest.
It is so dangerous asking a psychiatrist they want to talk about conflicts because I'm going to end up bearing my soul before we're all done. We want to talk this week a little bit about the treatment of depression. We wanted to start, as we did with anxiety a couple of months ago, with the non-pharmacologic approach to depression. Who is a good candidate for non-pharmacologic therapy?
Every child you think has depression. I will just throw that out there. Like, the recommendation for mild to moderate depression is therapy first, psychotherapy first, mm-hmm. and then adding medications later if you're not seeing benefit. And certainly for kids younger than 12, you know, therapy is the gold standard and the recommended treatment. And so, yes, always think psychotherapy for any kid that you're worried about having depression.
It seems to me that the biggest obstacles to that are first family buy-in, that people want to do this. Do you have any tricks? I don't mean to trick anyone. Any hints for how you can help people buy into the idea of psychotherapy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is such a good point because it is time consuming, right? If it's done well and if it's done thoroughly, it's an hour every week or every other week for a chunk of time, which, you know, sometimes for some families is just insurmountable, right? And so, you know, I do have that acknowledgement that there are some families and lifestyles that it's just not going to work for. But in general, I talk about, you know, this is the treatment for depression that is the most effective and that we have the most amount of evidence. We don't have to worry about side effects. It, you know, is safe. You don't have to take a medication. And, but it's going to take a while. And, you know, initially, like, your first session is really just going to be getting to know your therapist and the therapist getting to know you. And so you can't expect that there's going to be major changes after your first session. So go to your first session, go to a second session, see how that one goes. And then if it doesn't seem like it's going the way that you want it to, tell the therapist. and try to figure out what might be more helpful for you. And so I really try to empower people. A, it's going to be a process, and B, like, you can't expect, you know, especially to make any judgments in your first couple sessions. And then it's not like a relationship in which, you know, you don't want to hurt someone's feelings. The therapist's job is to provide the therapy that's going to be the most effective for, you know, the child and their family. And so they really should get feedback about what's working and what's not working so they can tailor the approach that they're using.
The second obstacle seems to be finding a therapist. Any hints there about, about how to begin the process for kids?
Yeah, that's a great question too. I think, so to be fair, I have nothing to disclose about this, right? But I use the psychologytoday.com website. And so certainly, like, looking for a therapist, there is a website sponsored by the American Psychological Association that I think that's who sponsors it anyway, but you can put in your zip code and it will find therapists in your area. You can specify what age, what insurances, what type of therapy. We'll talk about sort of the evidence-based therapies mm-hmm. that are used in kids. And then you can search for that. And I find that the therapists in that resource are a lot more up to date in which insurances they take than if you go through your insurance company, which sometimes can just be maddening, right? Because they have a list like 25 pages long and there's one person that's accepting patients, right?
Right. And also usually a lot more resources listed for adults than for kids.
Yeah, exactly. Another thing, you know, I certainly, word of mouth can be helpful, right? And so, I mean, you know, asking around could be helpful, although, you know, it just is a matter of seeing if, you know, you have somebody that has had that experience. A lot of people who work in, you know, are employed, right, have access to their employee assistance program. That can sometimes also be another good option to get some help for kids, right? Because dependents are typically included in that benefit as well. And then and seeing if your school's, you know, not just school counselors or psychologists, but like the school psychologist that does testing, but actual therapists that are doing like ongoing psychotherapy with children in schools.
And it seems like some of those things help address what really is often the third big obstacle, the way I see it, and that's cost.
It
can be quite costly, and you know, young families are often stressed, and so that's a stress for them. So is there anyone who's not a good candidate for non-pharmacologic therapy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly kids who are nonverbal. I mean, I think that's pretty clear, right? But I mean, I think there's some really skilled therapists that can do some pretty good behavioral therapy with kids that, you know, have more like intellectual disabilities. But you know, I think depending on the age in which you're hoping to get out of it, you know, sometimes you have to be pretty choosy about who you would pick for that therapy. And then, like I was saying before, I think sometimes like family chaos and organization, it just, you know, you can tell people that keep recommending therapy and just the way their life's going, they just can't seem to manage the organization surrounding it. So I think it's okay to continue to introduce, and also probably, you know, that would be an okay time to start medications instead.
Families have a lot of moving parts.
Right.
It's challenging. So what treatments have been studied and found effective for treating depression?
Yeah. So gold standard, of course, is cognitive behavioral therapy. We have shown over and over again that it can reach a par with medications. It just takes a little bit longer. So a lot of the studies with medications will go out about 12 weeks. And at that time, many studies, medications are still a little superior to therapy. But if you follow them out to about 36 weeks, the therapy candidates catch up and it's just as effective. And certainly numerous studies showing that the combination of cognitive behavioral therapy and medications is superior to either one alone for moderate to severe depression.
And is CBT the same here as it is for anxiety? Very similar process?
You know, it's similar. So there's a, like, the behavioral part is a little bit different. And I think people often forget the behavioral part is super important aspect of this treatment for both conditions. For depression, a lot of what we think about is behavioral activation. So it really is acting as if you're not depressed, getting out of bed, taking a shower, trying to regulate like when you're going to sleep, trying to regulate when you're eating, going maybe like go to the park and just sit outside, get out of your house, right? Right. So doing behavioral things that aren't just continuing to contribute to, you know, your depressive behaviors like isolation. For anxiety, a lot of the behavioral piece of it is really more exposures. And sometimes you can do those in depression too. Like if you've been depressed for long enough, you've avoided social situations that it can feel really uncomfortable to go out. Your self-esteem is probably really low to try to have a conversation even with friends. And so doing some little behaviors of just like, okay, we're going to go around kids that you don't know and just like stand near them at a park, right? And sort of working back to being more socially integrated again can be such a helpful piece. And then the younger the child, the more likely the behavioral interventions are going to be what you're focusing on, right? Like, you know, it's hard for them sometimes to identify their thoughts and change their thinking patterns, but they can certainly change their behaviors and they can certainly practice some of the coping skills, right, to manage when they're starting to feel more depressed or anxious.
I've seen references to interpersonal therapy. What is that?
Yeah, so that is a manualized short-term therapy that really focuses on interpersonal relationships, so with peers or with family members that can sort of improve or worsen your depression. And really the focus of the therapy is to try to strengthen those positive relationships and try to see kind of what that effect has on your mood. If it's done to fidelity, right, for both of them, they're manualized treatments. They follow a pretty, you know, prescribed path and kind of terminate about 12 weeks or so. I'll have to give a caveat that most therapists that we ever encounter don't practice those either type to fidelity, right? And so they might just take aspects of each evidence-based like platform and sort of use it to as they kind of want to do their own art of therapy. But the thing for both of them is there should be assignments and parents should be involved. I tell parents that all the time. If I get a kid, you know, into the hospital that I'm evaluating, and their parents are like, oh, we have no idea what they do in therapy. They need to get a new therapist because as we said last episode, I just can't see any, there's really no treating childhood and adolescent depression in a vacuum. You really have to involve the parents. People should be getting assignments. Parents should know what those assignments are. You know, the therapist doesn't have to disclose confidential things, but parents should know like, oh, hey, we're working on this exposure exercise or, you know, we're going to work on behavioral activation this week. Let's, you know, try to increase the ability for, you know, Johnny to get out of the house.
So a lot of people will rely on some informal things. I'm not talking about this as a substitute for therapy, but is there a benefit, for instance, to mindfulness training?
Yeah, definitely. I wish we had more robust studies because, you know, we have some small studies that show both benefit for mindfulness as well as dialectical behavioral therapy, which I think I'm springing on you, Paul, because we didn't talk about this before, but mindfulness makes me think about it. Yeah. So one of the things I try to talk to teens about, though, is, you know, it doesn't have to be meditation. I mean, some people love meditation and they think that's great. Some people just, you know, they cringe when they hear about meditation, right? And so there's other mindful things. I mean, even just talking about like, how can you live in the moment for, you know, like rock climbing is actually a really nice mindful activity if you do it appropriately. You can't really like, if you're climbing a wall, you can't really let your mind stray doing other things. Yoga can be really good mindfulness. There's certainly good mindfulness exercises that you can find, you know, on the web. I like something called Five Things, where you basically just use your five senses and just name five things about each of them in the moment, and it just can help center you again. Mm-hmm. And then kind of along the same lines, dialectical behavioral therapy is an offshoot of CBT that has shown to be beneficial for adults with borderline personality disorder. But we have some really good, you know, not high quality, but I think hopeful evidence about its use in adolescents, especially with like self-harm behavior. The day treatment program I work in, we have a skills group that we have all the teens go through. And it really is just learning coping skills and interpersonal effectiveness and how to, you know, ask for what you need in a way that's assertive and not aggressive. So very, very helpful for, I mean, I think really all teenagers and all of us, but is something that, you know, if parents are especially having children who have self-harm issues and perhaps some, you know, interpersonal relationship issues and maybe some intensity of emotion, DBT can be a really effective therapy as well.
You want to comment on complementary therapies? I mean, let's start. So I think as far as herbal therapies go, the one that you always hear about is St. John's Wort. You want to comment?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, St. John's wort, I read a little bit about this recently as well, just to make sure I'm up to speed, but, you know, has been shown to be effective and in a small scale for like mild depression. There's a little more evidence, of course, in adults. There was one open label trial that was published in the Journal of American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry about 10 years ago or so that did show some improvement over placebo. So I don't think it's unreasonable to use. The problem with it, a couple of things, right? Like you don't know what St. John's wort you're getting because it's not regulated by the FDA, right? And so I have no idea that the St. John's wort that's at the grocery store is the same one that they used in that study that showed benefit. And so I do think that's a real concern. And then the second concern is it has a lot of drug-drug interactions. It tends to induce the P450 metabolic system in the liver. And so, you know, if it's the only medicine that a child is on, you know, it's probably okay, right? Mm-hmm. But if they're taking it with any other medications, you just really would have to make sure that they don't interact with each other.
Any other complementary therapies that you've encountered that are either helpful or you'd warn people against?
Yeah. One thing that, I mean, I don't consider it necessarily complementary, but it really, it's non-pharmacological for sure, but would be light box therapy for kids who have like more seasonal affective disorder component to their depression. Mm-hmm. And there's not great studies in kids. There's good evidence in adults. And I really think, you know, the harm related to it is super duper low. And so I think it's worth trying if you have a kid that really just gets really depressed every fall and winter, and then they kind of spring back in the spring. I think thinking about using a light box would be appropriate. And then, you know, I think we talked briefly about acupuncture. I don't know there, you know, there's really limited evidence for its use for, especially for depression, even in adults or children again. So I certainly don't recommend it as a treatment, but wouldn't recommend against it. One thing I did want to point out is, you know, they have done studies looking at just the use of CAM medications for mental health. And really like less than 20% of the time are parents telling their doctors that they're doing it. And so I do think it's a really important thing to ask about and then just do some research. I have parents come in all the time with stuff that I haven't heard of or I haven't seen of before. And so I just look it up and try to do my best to figure out if it's harmful, helpful, or I mean, at least, you know, safe and who knows, right?
I saw a study several years ago that showed that in almost all chronic illnesses, people are using more complementary sorts of things, whether supplements or whatever. And you really will never know unless you ask people about it. And really, I think ask in an open sort of way. You know, a good opener is probably not what other nonsense are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, I just usually say I just need to know everything, vitamins, minerals, supplements, because they can interact with what I might want to use. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we talked last time about vitamin D. I mean, I don't necessarily think of that as a treatment, but certainly I think I'd consider that if they were deficient. You know, I'm sure you've had sleep talks. You know, melatonin is another one just to, you know, make sure to ask about, just so you know, right?
How long should somebody stay in therapy?
Yeah, you know, I mean, certainly not in perpetuity, right? I mean, we'll sometimes get kids that have been in the same therapist for like 2 years and they're still suffering with the same issues. And in my mind, then, you know, they probably need to change modality or change, you know, therapist or change approach or something. Most of the studies, you know, a good 3 months and, you know, 12 sessions. So, I mean, depending if you're going every week or every other week. One of our best studies, the treatment of adolescent depression studies, showed like the maximal benefit of therapy at about 36 weeks, right? So a little over half a year being in therapy, kind of cementing your cognitive behavioral therapy skills. Mm-hmm. I think it's always a good discussion to have with the therapist, sort of how things are progressing. There is some evidence. I mean, kids are so like placebo responsive, not saying therapy is placebo, but even like brief interventions can be really, really effective for children. And you know, so I don't think there's like a too little time or so. I think it's more like, are you improving? Is it helpful? Are you still getting benefit from it? Or you know, have your symptoms gotten to the point that it just sort of seems like you're kind of looking at each other when you're in therapy and there's not a lot of work to be done anymore?
Yeah. I'm going to ask you to comment on a couple of therapies that that are not in the same sort of realm, but are non-pharmacologic therapies. One is, is there a role for electroconvulsive therapy in, especially in older adolescents?
Yeah, so that's a great question. There definitely is. We kind of talked about, you know, what are the risks of waiting too long? And I mean, it's in the same realm as that, right? If you've been in treatment, if you've had an adolescent that has been, you know, getting multiple psychotropics that really isn't improving and their depression remains really high, ECT is very efficacious. We use it with adolescents. They improve. They actually tend to tolerate it. This is speaking anecdotally, not from evidence, but they really seem to tolerate it a little bit better than adults do as far as some of the side effects that they have as well. I think, you know, the biggest issue is just it has such bad stigma and sort of publicity in the media, right?
Everyone thinks one floor of the cuckoo's nest.
And it's done. I mean, it's done in such a medical, family-centered way. When we have kids who are ill enough to get ECT, I mean, we certainly have multiple doctors who will evaluate them and recommend it. It is approved down to the age of 13, and so even like your younger adolescents that seem to continue to struggle with their depressive symptoms and just aren't functioning, I think it's something to think about kind of earlier rather than later. And you know, it's done under general anesthesia. They're paralyzed, so they don't actually feel the seizure. Mm-hmm. Family can be in the room and watch the treatment. They're supported through the, you know, through the sort of recovery period. Mm-hmm. It's really, I mean, and it can be super effective for treatment resistant depression.
Well, that's very interesting. Also, something I had never heard of before, RTMS, repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation. What is that?
So it's basically like, I'm using my hands here, which nobody who's listening to this podcast can hear, right? But it's a magnet that is put over your skull, and it basically realigns kind of the pole that the electrons are aligned against. It's not as specific as what ECT can be, and so it's not as effective as ECT, but it is less invasive, right? I mean, you certainly don't need anesthesia. You don't need, you know, any sort of medical workup before you can undergo it. At the moment, it's not approved for use in adolescents, and most insurance companies won't pay for it. And so, you know, there are some times where it's considered for adolescents and families have chosen to pay out of pocket to get it. But we just, at this point, don't have enough evidence for its use in adolescents.
How long has that been around?
Oh, that's such a good question. 15 years, maybe?
Okay.
I might be under, I don't know, time is irrelevant anymore, right? Like, but I certainly it wasn't present when I was a resident and it has sort of evolved. I mean, I think it was in its like experimental phase at that point. So I think, you know, somewhere between 15 and 20 years. But
so I can be embarrassed I haven't heard about it, but I shouldn't be ashamed.
No, not at all. Especially because it's not approved for use in kids and adolescents. And so really it's something that I don't think anyone should think about if you're a pediatrician, right? I think if you have a kid that you're worried that just has treatment resistant depression, such a good reason to refer them to a psychiatrist. And then they can decide if it's a good referral to go to see a TMS doc or an ECT doc or not.
That sounds perfect. Well, so much to think about, Christy. This has been very helpful. I'm sure that people will have questions. Please send your questions to questions@vcurb.com. It's always nice that we can sort of pursue some of these lines a little further based on what people are thinking. I appreciate your time. Thanks for spending some time with us. And we'll talk to you again next week about the pharmacologic treatments of depression. See you then.
Sounds great. See you next week.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.